We stand at the corner of a street, where the bass is so loud it shakes the marrow in our bones. It is a sound that defines us. It is the heartbeat of the Caribbean. But for decades, that heartbeat has been synchronized with the rhythm of the street. We are talking about an entanglement that goes deeper than just lyrics on a record. It is a story of patronage and power, where the studio booth and the concrete jungle become one and the same. From the zinc fences of Kingston to the hills of Port of Spain, the music has never just been about the melody. It has been about who owns the airwaves and who controls the ground. When the money for the microphone comes from the man who runs the block, the art changes, it hardens. We have watched our culture walk a thin line between creative genius and criminal reality. Today, we look at the cost of that connection. We ask what happens when the song becomes a shield for the shadow. In the early 1980s, the landscape of our music shifted. The grand political promises of the 1970s had begun to rot. The massive peace concerts that once brought rival leaders together under a banner of unity were fading memories. What took their place was something more localized and much more dangerous. The rise of the sound system era brought a new kind of power to the neighborhood. This was the era of the dancehall don. In Jamaica and across the waters in Trinidad, the central government often felt like a distant ghost. The real authority lived in the community. These were the men who provided the school books, the food, and the protection. They also provided the entertainment. To understand the music of this time, we have to understand the economy of the garrison. A young artist with a voice and a dream did not go to a bank for a loan. They went to the man who held the keys to the area. This was the birth of a complex patronage system. The Don would fund the recording session. He would pay for the vinyl to be pressed. He would ensure the sound system played the track on every corner until the neighborhood knew every word. This was not just out of a love for the arts. It was about branding. A hit song that praised a specific leader or a specific territory was better than any political poster. It cemented the status of the provider. The studio became an extension of the street office. When we listen back to the recordings of the 1980s, we can hear the transition. The themes of global revolution were replaced by the realities of local survival. The lyrics became hyper-local. They spoke of specific streets and specific men who were seen as the ultimate providers. For the artist, this was a survival tactic. To have the backing of a powerful figure meant you were safe. You had access to the best equipment and the biggest audiences. But that safety came with a heavy price tag. You were no longer just a singer. You were a representative of a faction. If your patron fell out with a rival, you were now a target. If you refused to record a song that glorified a specific act of violence, the funding disappeared. The music began to reflect the tension of the streets, because the streets were literally paying for the electricity in the studio. We see this play out in the way the sessions were run. The Don would often be present in the room, surrounded by his circle. The pressure to perform was not just about hitting the right note. It was about proving loyalty. This entanglement created a new sound that was grittier and more immediate. It was the sound of a community under pressure, finding its voice through the filter of unauthorized power. As the decade progressed, the influence of these figures grew beyond the local dance. They began to see the international potential of the music they were funding. The records were finding their way to London and New York. This meant the influence of the street was being exported to our diaspora. The culture was being shaped by a shadow economy that the official systems could not touch. We have to ask ourselves if the music could have ever evolved without this underground support. The official institutions were often hostile to the sounds of the grassroots. They saw it as noise or as a threat to social order. In that vacuum, the man on the corner became the patron of the arts. He filled a gap that the state ignored. But in doing so, he tethered the creative spirit of our people to the volatile world of organized crime. The stakes were rising with every hit record. The local hero and the local criminal were becoming the same person in the eyes of the youth. By the time the 1980s were drawing to a close, the foundation was set for a much more violent era. The music was no longer just reflecting the struggle, it was being used to direct it. The microphone was becoming as powerful as any weapon on the street. Every new rhythm carried the weight of an unspoken agreement. The art was thriving, but the artist was walking into a trap that would take decades to spring. The transition into the 1990s and the early 2000s saw the rise of the digital frontline. The technology changed, but the entanglement only deepened. We moved from the era of vinyl to the era of the compact disc and eventually the digital file. This made the music move faster than ever before. It also made the conflicts more immediate. The lyrical war that had been a staple of our culture began to take on a deadly edge. In the past, a clash between two artists was often a display of skill and wit. By the late 90s, it had transformed into a real-time tracking of rivals. The music videos became territorial markers. If an artist filmed a video in a certain part of Kingston or a specific neighborhood in Port of Spain, it was a declaration of ownership. The badman persona was no longer just a character played for the sake of a performance. It became a global commodity. The world wanted the grit. They wanted the authentic sound of the Caribbean streets. This global demand put immense pressure on the performers to live up to the image they were selling. We saw the rise of the superstar, who was also a street figure. The line between the stage and the concrete was erased. The fans were no longer just listening to music. They were choosing sides in a conflict that had real-world consequences. We saw this most clearly in the spike of violence that would often follow major music festivals or clash events. A single line in a song could trigger a retaliation in a community miles away. The lyrics were being used as intelligence. They were being used to boast about crimes or to threaten enemies. The authorities began to take notice. They realized that the music was serving as a communication network for groups that were operating outside the law. The midpoint of this era brought a new kind of rupture. It was the emergence of the organized fan base that functioned like a paramilitary wing. These were not just people who liked the songs. These were people who were willing to fight for the reputation of the artist and the territory they represented. The pressure on the artists themselves was immense. Many found themselves trapped in a cycle where they had to constantly escalate their rhetoric to remain relevant. If they tried to pivot to more conscious or peaceful themes, they were often accused of being soft or of turning their backs on the people who funded their rise. The trap was now fully operational. The artist was a prisoner of their own success. They were wealthy and famous, but they could not move freely in their own islands. They were tied to the demands of the street leaders who expected a return on their early investments. This return was often in the form of public loyalty or financial support for the group's activities. We saw high-profile artists being called into police stations not for their music, but for their associations. The digital age meant that every movement was recorded, every link was documented. The music was no longer a path out of the ghetto. For many, it had become a gilded cage. The violence was no longer a distant threat. It was happening at the stage door. It was happening in the VIP sections of the clubs. The culture was being consumed by the very energy it used to find its power. We were watching our brightest stars burn out in a cycle of arrests, shootings, and legal battles. The world was watching too. The image of the Caribbean was being redefined by this era of tension. The music was still incredible. It was still the most innovative sound on the planet. But it was being built on a foundation of increasing instability. The midpoint turn had arrived. The music was no longer just the voice of the people. It had become the soundtrack to a war that no one knew how to end. The microphone was now a target. The final gate of this entanglement leads us into the courtrooms and onto the concrete of the modern era. We have seen the ultimate consequence of the merger between music and the street. In the last 15 years, the state has stopped looking at the music as just art and started looking at it as evidence. We have watched as some of our most prolific artists have been taken from the stage and placed in the dock. Their lyrics are no longer just songs to the prosecution. They are confessions. They are blueprints of criminal activity. This has sparked a massive debate across our islands. Can a poem be a crime? Is an artist responsible for the actions of their fans? We saw the ultimate manifestation of this divide in the Gully and Gaza phenomenon. This was more than just a musical rivalry. It was a social fracture that split the youth of Jamaica down the middle. It reached into the schools. Children were carrying markers to identify themselves with one faction or the other. The violence associated with this divide was real. The state's response was swift and heavy-handed. We saw the banning of records from the airwaves. We saw the implementation of emergency powers in areas where the music was seen as an incitement to riot. The cost to the community has been staggering. We have lost a generation of talent to the prison system or to the grave. But the music survives. It always survives. It adapts to the censorship. It finds new ways to reach the people through the internet and social media. The incarceration of a major artist often only serves to increase their legend. Their voice becomes even more powerful when it is coming from behind a wall. This is the tragic irony of our history. The more the system tries to suppress the sound, the more the streets embrace it as the only truth they have. We have to look at the legacy of this entanglement. It has given us some of the most raw and honest music ever recorded. It has documented a side of our history that the history books like to ignore. It has shown the resilience of a people who can find beauty in the middle of a war zone, but it has also left us with a trail of broken families and scarred communities. The impact on the youth is the most pressing concern. When the only path to success appears to be through the glorification of a dangerous lifestyle, the future of our culture is at stake. We have seen the state try to intervene with social programs and alternative music projects, but these often fail to capture the same energy as the music born from the struggle. The truth is that the music and the street are still tied together by an umbilical cord of economic reality. As long as the official systems fail to provide for the people, the shadow systems will continue to fund the culture. We are left with a landscape where the music is both our greatest achievement and our most difficult challenge. The court cases continue, the arrests continue, and every night, in a studio somewhere in the Caribbean, a young person is stepping up to a microphone to tell their story. They are deciding whether to play it safe or to tell the truth of what they see outside their door. They are entering the same entanglement that claimed those who came before them. The bass is still shaking the ground. The rhythm is still driving the dance. But the silence that follows the record is where the real weight of our history lives. The song has ended, but the consequences are still playing out in the streets.